Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Michael J. Turner about his new book, Radicalism and Reputation, The Career of Brontaire O'Brien. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here.
Oh, we're pleased to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm from England. I was born in Berkshire, about an hour from London. I was educated at Oxford, where I did my first degree and also my doctorate. And I ended up here in America at Appalachian State University as a distinguished professor in 2008.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, was Brontaire O'Brien a subject that you had done a lot of previous work on, or what was it that led you to write a biography about him?
Well, most of my work has been on reform movements, and I was interested in him in a small way when I was doing other projects in previous years. And I started to write some things about the way that British radicals viewed America, and he sort of came up in that. So there was a reason to look more deeply into his ideas. And as I did that, and I finished the other project I was working on, I thought that there might be some mileage in taking a study of O'Brien a little bit further. I did a few conference papers just to test the water and see if there was interest in this and if there was really any life in it. And they went well, so I thought I would press on, and I ended up doing the book.
Okay. What is it about Brontaire O'Brien that makes him so significant? Because he's not a necessarily a name that pops up at first blush when you're looking at British political history in the early and mid 19th century. I mean, there you're talking about people like, say, Lord Grey or Fergus O'Connor or Daniel O'Connell. And while Brontaire O'Brien, as you explain in your book, was significant, he doesn't necessarily come across as a person of sort of at the forefront of change. What does he do over the course of his life that makes him a figure worthy of attention today?
Well, he's, for a fairly short time, he was a true radical celebrity. And you're right. I mean, there are many of these other figures who are more well-known and overshadow him. And, of course, his rivalry with O'Connor was one of the defining things about his career and why O'Brien's career didn't go the way that he expected and wanted it to go. But his significance, I think, is that he's there at the time when reform aspirations really took off and when a lot seemed possible, real change seemed possible. And he managed to put together some ideas and a program of realistic policies that really lasted. And although they get reshaped and so on later on by some of his successors and into the 20th century by center and center left politics in Britain, some of those, some of the same vocabulary and some of the same ideas are still there. So he does have this lasting influence, even if it's combined with the influence of other people. But nevertheless, to overlook his role in that just seems to be a little bit unfair and a little bit not really respecting the history and the record, really, of the effort by reformers who were interested in changing, who were interested in thinking about what Britain could become, what it might look like. So I think his role in all of that deserves maybe to, a bit more attention than perhaps it's received. I think for historians of Chartism, he's well known. But then, of course, outside that field, maybe in broader reform politics, maybe he's not so well known. And that's probably, a good reason why I hope that the book sort of reaches some of those people and that they're able to see maybe the role that he did play.
That's one of the approaches you take in your book that I thought was very interesting, because in your beginning chapter, you get into the historiography of Brontë O'Brien. And it seems that so many people since his death have sort of taken him and made him into something that he wasn't necessarily, sort of this bridge between the radicalism of the early 19th century and the emerging socialist movement of later in the century. And what you've done in your book is you've kind of gotten to look at what O'Brien himself was doing and how he was arguing things, and kind of paring away this sense of, well, we're going to use him as this intermediary between this early radical thought and this later left-wing thinking.
Yeah, I think he is a link a link figure. Some of the things about him are maybe a bit, like I said, I mean, there is a certain neglect of his true, or maybe the extent of his importance. But at the same time, for those who were enthusiasts on the political left, and particularly in the 20th century, looking at him as a kind of a model or an inspiration or so on. I mean, some of that could be argued. Some of that is perhaps a little bit overblown. Because there probably were more influential figures even during his lifetime. Indeed, there were, and I mean, that's one of the things that he was perhaps a bit jealous about, that he hadn't received the kind of recognition and also the material rewards in some respect that he thought he deserved for his sort of sacrifices and for his efforts on behalf of the people and on behalf of reform causes, but he certainly is a link figure, but he's not only that. I mean, I think there's a case as well to say that, looking back to the 1780s, the 1790s, before he was born, some of the things that he read in his youth and some of the things in his 20s and in his 30s, that when he was forming his ideas and forming his program, some of the things he read previous to his own career, you could see him as like a culmination of attitudes and impulse, reform impulses, as well as somebody who leads to the future as well. So there is, you could look both ways, but I think as a link figure, he deserves to be seen in that way as well.
I was wondering, I mean, in reading the book, you really, it's understandable why he is so inspirational, because you describe he doesn't come from the elites. He is not a person of great means. He really has a bit of a struggle to become a prominent figure. And it's one that really speaks, I thought, to his abilities as a person, as a writer and as a polemicist.
Yeah, absolutely. He was anti-elite. He certainly, I think if you think about his birth and his growing up in Ireland, rural Ireland, a small place, not particularly an important place. I think even today, Granard there in County Longford, I think even today it's got less than 1,500 people living there. I mean, it's not a privileged background at all, not a particularly hopeful background. His father, of course, died when he was young, and that's got to have an effect as well, not just emotionally and psychologically, but also, of course, on your material circumstances, with the breadwinner gone. And I think it does speak to his the things that built his career, that it's really through his intellectual development, his drive to make himself something, that counts for a lot, definitely. I don't think he was, they weren't, I think the family was not really at the absolute bottom. I think as a child, his position was probably a little bit better than many of the people around in that part of Central Ireland there. And the fact that he was spotted and given an opportunity to go to a good school, you know, a sort of experimental school, the Edgeworth family set up this school. It was in a town a little bit to the southwest of where O'Brien grew up. So it was local. It may have been that he had he never been spotted, he probably never would have really risen to the intellectual terms in the way that he did. But the fact that he was able to go there and he thrived in that environment, and it was this kind of experimental schooling was really to push the individual to improve. And it was a monitorial school, so the elder children would be trained and then would teach the younger children. He ends up as the chief monitor in that school. He's given, you know, there's a story about him being given a wonderful a gift of these very valuable books because he was such a good student. He goes on, to university, trains in the law, moves to London. These are things which were not inevitable, but by his own drive and by his will to make something of himself, despite not a particularly easy upbringing. They were, as I say, they weren't dirt poor, but they were not rich. There was no reason to suppose that he would be going off to London to train as a lawyer. But he was able to do that, and he won prizes for his academic accomplishments. He was obviously a smart individual, a clever individual. And he managed to find people to push him and to give him opportunities so that he could develop his mind and his reading and all those the skills that go with that. And that's the way that really his entry into London and into eventually into radical politics.
That move to London really struck me because, you know, given what was going on in Ireland during the time, this is when you're he's coming of age during Daniel O'Connell and his movement for Catholic emancipation, and you're starting to see a more assertive Catholic Irish identity in the island's politics. And yet, when he moves to London, he really is in effect charting a course that would have been very different had he stayed in Ireland. Why did he move to London as opposed to staying in Ireland? And why did he end up moving away from this career in the law to one as an activist?
Well, he had to go to London to finish his qualifications. So that was one reason. I think also maybe the idea that there wasn't there wouldn't be so many opportunities, partly because of the religious disabilities and you know the social and political problems that there were in Ireland that you've just referred to. So London might have been a place where he thought, well, maybe there'll be opportunity there as well. With regard to abandoning the law as a career, the way he explained it himself was that he realised that the law was corrupt and was about exploitation. It was one of the tools that the people with the money and the property used to keep everybody else down. There was that sort of turning against it. But he probably wouldn't have thought that way had he not started to attend some meetings and read material that was around at the time. You know, London was a place in great excitement at this time because of the reform crisis in England that led to the Great Reform Act in 1832. So he goes there really at the time when a lot of this is kicking off. And so he's drawn into some of these meetings and he associates with some of these people that are pressing for electoral reform, electoral rights, parliamentary reform. And so he gets, associates with some of these people, starts to read more, and that's really, again, when it comes to the opportunity that comes that for him to start writing about these reform questions that are so up in the air at the at that moment. And that's really how he gets into that. And he decides he likes it. He decides he's good at it. He has a go at speaking at some of these meetings. Some of the more well-known reformers at the time are encouraging him to do that. And that's his opening, really, into this other path that he decides he wants to take. So it's really the time and the place coming together with this young man who's got these ambitions, who's got these talents. He wants to put these talents to use. He wants to be noticed. So it's really that combination of circumstances which came together just at the right combination for him to have these opportunities to get involved in reform politics.
It seems that even though there was this opportune moment for him, though, was that he was still constrained in a lot of ways, because politics in Britain during this period especially was very much of a rich person's game. You could get elected to Parliament if you could get people to vote for you, but at the time there was no income, there was no salary for members of Parliament, so you had to be able to earn a living. And so there's this question of how do you make a living as an activist? And I was wondering, was that a contributing factor in what drew him into journalism, or in what ways did he try to shape his career with an eye towards earning a living while working as an activist?
Well, I think the two things that you mentioned there, that's really the answer to this. Yes, he needs to earn some money, but also because this is a time of excitement, because it's a time where reform seems to be coming, and of course after 1832, although the electorate is not expanded as greatly as some of these radicals really wanted, and nevertheless, the door has been opened. And in the 1830s, you start to get changes, in Ireland too, but you start to get other very important reforms that are brought in the 1830s. So it looks like the door is opening. So there would be an opportunity to, first of all, to have a career as an activist, but primarily as a writer. And that takes off, and he makes his mark really quite quickly. It's within a couple of years of arriving in London. He makes his mark quite quickly, and he's already got a pen name, by which he's known, Bronte. So it's making a living, and it's the opportunity to exert some influence, to be involved in this very exciting movement where the potential already seems to be there to start to make some fundamental changes in the British state. And then through that, you can start to get some of the social and economic justice that you're seeking as well. So you can get rid of this very top-down hierarchical structure with the elites in control of everything. So it's those two things together, the opportunity to make a living, but also the opportunity to exert some influence and be part of something that's meaningful and important and will bring change.
How is it that he's able to emerge so quickly as a journalist? Is it that he just met the moment? Was he regarded as an exceptionally able writer among the ranks of the journalists among the radicals? What was that allowed him to establish such a reputation so quickly?
Well, it is opportunity. There was a real burgeoning of this radical movement. It needed the exchange of information and ideas. So the press was the obvious way that kind of communication and that kind of build-up of momentum could happen. So there's an opportunity there. There are lots of different publications that start to emerge. So there's a chance there. And then you combine that with, as you refer to, obviously he's got talent. Once he gets the opportunity, he's really able to take it. And he has useful associations as well. I mean, the first thing that he started to write for was the political letters, and William Carpenter ran those, and they were, these periodical things that came out. But William Carpenter was an established figure in journalism. And then after Carpenter, of course, by the time you get to 1832, you've got Hetherington and Henry Hetherington. was a, again, a well-established London radical newspaper man. So he's lucky in the sense that he does have these associations which give him an opportunity. And once he does start writing and begins to build up a little bit of a following, he has a short period in Birmingham, but then he comes back to London, and then on Hetherington's Poor Man's Guardian, which was the sort of the top selling radical publication for the sort of lower social ranks, in a very sort of popular language and that kind of populist sort of tone. Once he's on there and he's his name is out there, then that sets him up for the rest of the 1830s, really, because it provides him with that reputation. It provides him with a readership. And now he's a known figure. So his hope would have been to build on that. Once the Poor Man's Guardian folds in 1835, the idea would have been to sort of find other outlets. And he does for a short time, but it doesn't sort of go as well as he was expecting. But I suppose then with Chartism, once Chartism, which is really probably the most important popular political mobilization in the whole of the 19th century in Britain, and of course has repercussions overseas as well, in America, in Europe, and in parts of the empire, is a very important movement. And once that happens, 36, 37, 38, around about that time when it's taking off, this was another opportunity for him. So again, the demand for ideas, information, the explosion of information, really, with the press, there's another opportunity there as well. So it was possible to sustain it, but as I've sort of outlined in the book, really there are reasons why he wasn't able to do that. But the opportunity arising and the talent that he had, and then his ability to build and sustain that reputation that he gets, particularly on the Poor Man's Guardian, those are really the key to his rise in the 1830s.
There's an undertone, though, of frustration for him that you describe, because he established this reputation as a radical journalist early on, and he's advocating all of these ideas which were very cutting edge for the time, and we'll get into those in just a few minutes, but the frustration comes from the fact that he wants to be a bit more than a journalist, and you refer to his efforts to establish his own papers. And I was wondering if you could explain why those worked. Was that a function of the limits of his abilities as an organizer, or was it more a reflection of the environment for publications in the 1830s?
I think you'd have to say both of those things had an impact. I think, once he'd worked with people like Carpenter and Hetherington, I mean, he wanted to be them. He wanted to be his own sort of successful entrepreneur in the newspaper business, pushing radical causes. And the fact is, though, that, once reform is taking off in the 1830s, and, it's quite an overcrowded field. You've got a lot of publications now all sort of pushing for, and it's all very well getting a high readership, but it's sales that it's going to bring you in the money. You need the advertising revenue. You need the business side of it sorted out. And as I mentioned, I mean, it is quite an overcrowded field. So trying to establish yourself in that field, unless you've really got something amazingly special and you're very, very lucky, it's difficult. There are lots of radical publications that were very short-lived, only a few months or a couple of years and then couldn't survive. Of course, there were very, very many others that did survive and lasted a long time and became well established. But I think that was his idea, that he would go on to be the type of figure that instead of working for them, writing for them, he would actually be writing for himself and owning his own titles and running them and editing them and so on. That was his idea. And he probably had the talent to do it in a small way, but on the business side of it, because it was quite difficult, as I mentioned, to establish yourself in an overcrowded field, He wasn't so good maybe on the business side of it. He tended to be perhaps a little bit over-optimistic and to underestimate the difficulty that we would face. Plus, you do still have taxes and various other limitations on the radical press because the government, of course, doesn't like being criticized and questioned. And so anything that goes perhaps a little bit too far or gets on the wrong side of officialdom is going to face some pressures as well. And he does blame some of his failures on that type of persecution as well. So he wasn't able to really make the impact that he wanted on that side of things. And it's largely because of perhaps he didn't realize how difficult it was organizationally, financially. I mean, you need investment, you need a bit of capital to be able to set up and to last through maybe some periods of not so good sales and not so good revenues from advertising and so on. And he didn't quite appreciate how difficult that would be, and hence the series of rather short-lived and disappointing titles that he was associated with. Sometimes he was co-owner, sometimes he was owner, sometimes he was just editor and worked for others. But all of these things, they never really lasted very long. It made him bitter. The thing was that the one way in which they can be regarded as a success, however, is in ideas. I mean, in pushing some very bold and interesting ideas and having an impact on the reform debate. In that sense, I mean, it worked. It's just that he wasn't really able to make a very comfortable living out of that because of the business and organizational things that we've just been thinking about.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit about those ideas. I mean, what was he advocating? How was he promoting? You know, what sort of changes was he promoting? And was there any sort of evolution in his thinking during this period in the 1830s that brought him to Chartism, or was he basically fully formed and waiting for something like Chartism to come around?
Well, Chartism can be seen as a continuation of earlier radicalism. The thing that Chartism had was it had the mass mobilization and the huge meetings, the infrastructure, the organization, all the various aspects of posters and dress and banners and slogans and all of those things, maybe that on a scale that hadn't really been seen before. But in terms of its ideas, I mean, the main program, the 6 points of the People's Charter, those weren't new. They'd been around for quite a long time. I can just remind everybody of what those 6 points were. I mean, you've got manhood suffrage, which is the main one. And this is something that O'Brien never departed from, that the beginning of any real change was going to be the right to vote, for all adult males to be able to vote and have a share in power, really, in making the laws and so on, and shaping government policies and so on. So manhood suffrage is one of the 6 points. And then you've got annual parliaments and the vote by ballot, which is a protection, you know, secret voting, so that you'd be free to exercise your right independently. Equal electoral districts, which again goes towards the representation. No property qualification for members of parliament, so that anyone could become an MP, and then salaries for MPs as well, so they'd be paid, so they could give up their jobs if they wanted, and it meant that working class men would be able to go into parliament. So those 6 points, which is that's the People's Charter. If you take that as a kind of continuation from earlier radicalism, by the time it does take off and you do have a Chartist movement towards the end of the 1830s, O'Brien is familiar with all that stuff. He's very much behind it. He never really departs from it. He really stays a Chartist until the end of his life. It's just that he sees that the Charter can lead to other things. And so there is an evolution in his ideas, as you mentioned, And this is that he adds to the charter. He has other ideas about what the charter might lead to. Once you've democratized the system of government, it opens up all kinds of possibilities for you to reorganize the economy and society, even things like communication and the press and the universities and all sorts of things. But you do need to democratize the system of government first in order for you to get these social equality and economic opportunities and so on that you're looking for to have a more equal and just kind of Britain. So that's the long-term aim, is this very ambitious idea that you can really change Britain, that there can be fundamental change, and you won't have the elites in control anymore. You won't have unearned privilege. You won't have unfair laws. You won't have people being excluded from rights and opportunities. But you do need the charter first. So that's always something that he insisted on. He never, and particularly as I mentioned, particularly the vote. The vote was the key to getting these wider and broader changes that he had in view. And after a while, he starts to focus more on the things that the charter will lead to. And that's where his social and economic agenda comes in.
One of the interesting things that you focus on in your book is his relationship to America. And it's a relationship that is an abstract one in most sense, because he doesn't spend time there or anything, but America has this unique standing in his mind and this unique place in terms of his thinking and in terms of how it relates to a lot of these ideas you've talked about. And I was wondering if you could expand upon that just a little bit.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of interest in America because, of course, it was seen. In some ways, still in the early 19th century, it was seen as it was a child of Britain, if you like. It was British people had created it, and so British laws, British values, even some even though the Constitution was different, there were similarities with the British Constitution. So there was an idea that America maybe represented a better type of Britain, or maybe a future, some kind of resemblance might be there. It's not that Britain would be like America, but perhaps that Britain could be more like America in the more positive aspects of what they thought America was like. Of course, a lot of these people didn't. Go ahead.
I was going to say I like the way you summarize it in the chapter title, which is America's democratic promise. It's the idea that it embodies a lot of what Britain could become, but not that Britain should necessarily, as you said, become exactly like the United States, but that there you have things like a more expanded franchise, no property qualifications to serve in politics, and even salaries for representatives. And so it becomes reference American history, the city on the hill in some ways, even though that doesn't, as you explained it, in O'Brien's mind, it doesn't necessarily correspond to the reality of America at that time as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's one of those it's like a model, but more in a general way, that somehow there are some things that America has got right and that Britain still hasn't got right. And so certainly with regard to reform and justice and some of those broader kind of aspiration, that there's definitely this notion that America's got some things right and we could learn. We could learn from some of the things that America is doing. I mean, there are plenty of criticism, negative criticisms of America as well. And so there is a balance to this, but he's sure that America has things to teach Britain, but he's equally sure that as his own reform program matures, he can also teach America things. I mean, of course, a lot of his followers eventually did come to America, and one place where they set up a model community was in Kansas, where they tried to live out some of the social and economic teachings that O'Brien had developed by the end of the 1840s and the beginning of the 1850s. So there's this kind of interaction. So it's not all one way, yes, America has a very important part in his thinking, as it did for many British radicals in that period.
We've been talking about Chartism in terms of its relationship to Brontë O'Brien's life and his career. I was wondering if we could maybe go back and talk a bit about Chartism generally, like why it emerges, where it comes from, and then delve a bit more into what was his practical role in Chartism what was his position within the movement itself, and what did he do during this period of great Chartist ferment in the late 1830s?
Yeah, there are probably a number of sort of key explanations as to why Chartism did arise. As I mentioned before, there is this view among a number of historians that it's really a continuation of earlier radical ideas and radical techniques and methods and so on. But I think sort of the reason why it happened when it did is probably has a lot to do with disappointment after the 1832 Reform Act, which it was a significant reform and it did open the door, as I referred to previously, but it didn't really bring the fundamental shift that a lot of the particularly the lower class reformers had expected. The vote is still restricted to a very small proportion of the adult male population. So access and participation to really the centres of power are still substantially closed off. It doesn't mean though that participation isn't growing, because even those, of course, who couldn't vote could still be politically active. And then there are other things that happened, maybe sort of a coercive Irish policy, maybe the policy towards the factories and the trade unions. I mean, working men probably had a lot of resentment in this period, and a lot was changing with the Industrial Revolution and the growth of towns. There was a lot of social dislocation and social and economic challenges. So taken together, the idea of a movement to get greater change than had previously been granted by the British state, it probably explains why Chartism sort of arose at that time. And with the 6 points of the Charter, with some established radical leaders, with the growth of the Chartist press and communication and local Chartist bodies and organizational framework for the movement, it does take off and it attracts a lot of support. And as I mentioned, it's really on a scale that hadn't been seen before in terms of its size and its influence. The government probably isn't too worried overall, but there are times when the government does have to respond, because it does seem like a serious challenge to the established order. And by 1839, 1839 is one of the peak years of agitation, and it really shows that Chartism had arrived. And O'Brien was already a celebrity when Chartism was taking off, so he was already known. He's still writing in 36, 37, 38. And then I think the key breakthrough for him is when he joins the Northern Star, because the Northern Star emerges as the major Chartist newspaper. And, of course, it's run by Fergus O'Connor, and they'd been allies, and they knew each other, supported each other up to this point. And so O'Brien gets this opportunity to be part of a very successful, what becomes a very successful radical newspaper. And of course, when he starts to write for it, he's able to both enhance his own reputation, but also contribute to the success of the Northern Star itself. So they kind of serve each other's interests, and it works okay for a while. Unfortunately for O'Brien, prison sort of changes an awful lot for him when he's sent to prison at the beginning of 1840, and that's the beginning really of some major difficulties, because although he still has a name, he still has celebrity status, he still has a following, he still has influence when he comes out of prison. So much has changed, really, for him personally and politically. And, of course, the breach with O'Connor is very important in that respect as well. That his role as one of the major leaders in early Chartism, he cannot sustain that. And he breaks with many of the other Chartist leaders in the course of the early and mid-1840s, which rather isolates him and sort of sets him apart. He doesn't give up. I mean, he keeps going, but it does mean that certainly his opportunity, for instance, to earn a living from his political writing and from his speaking, that's starting really to be restricted now, because he's lost some of those relationships and some of those opportunities that he had before.
His imprisonment does serve as, in your book, as the start of this major turning point in his life. I was wondering if you could explain a bit how it was that he ended up being arrested and imprisoned during this peak period of Chartist activity.
Because he was so active and so high profile and so important to the movement, in 1839, when the government started to get a little bit more concerned about the potential that the Chartist movement was showing, there was an official backlash. There were violent outbreaks in 1839. How much they were invented, of course, is still a matter for debate among historians. How violent they were, how serious a challenge they really did pose to the established order, that's a matter for opinion and disagreement among historians. But the fact is, there was violence, so the government is seeking to strike a blow at the movement and maybe remove its momentum and put some of its leaders in prison, you know, wrap them on the knuckles a little bit. And so O'Brien is one of those who is singled out. He wins a victory to start with, though, because his first trial, which is up in the northeast of England, after a run of meetings and speeches and so on, he's acquitted. He conducts his own defense, and being very good with words and very smart and able to think on his feet and so on, he's able to convince the jury that they shouldn't convict. But within weeks, he's tried again in a different place. And what's quite interesting about the second trial, which was in Liverpool in February of 1840, what's quite interesting about that is that he's charged with sedition, but it doesn't actually relate to any specific meeting or speech or any specific event. It's really a run of meetings and events and speeches, and so it's quite difficult to come up with an effective defense when it's that nature of charge. And he also feels let down. He thinks that, he says later, he thinks that some of the other Chartists are going to come to his defense. They're going to speak for him. He's going to call them as witnesses. Maybe there'd been some promise of support with his legal fees and things like this. It's not very clear, but there were a lot of accusations afterwards that he'd been let down. And so he's sent to prison. 18 months in prison. It affects his health. It affects his morale. It affects his. It affects his future hugely. And when he comes out, he's really he's not toned down his ideas at all. He's still just as radical and bold and forthright in terms of his ideas as he'd been before. But the situation has changed. He's lost. Certain opportunities, maybe, as I said before, certain opportunities for earning money as a writer and a speaker. The breach with O'Connor is crucially important, because O'Connor by this time is really rising as the main national figurehead for the movement. And the National Star, which is O'Connor's newspaper, is really the main organ nationally as well for the Chartist movement, and very important to sort of coordinate all the different localities and all the different aspects, because Chartism is quite a varied movement. It's not a uniform movement by any means. There's a lot of local variation. So to keep it together, you need something like the National Star. And O'Connor would also argue that you need one leader. And so he's the one who thinks, well, for the good of the movement, I have to be the main man. And that also, there's a certain ego and ambition about that too. And there are those historians who think that O'Connor was pretty much a disaster for the movement. But there's also those who think that he was right, you know, that you did need some unifying force, some unifying leader, figure. And O'Brien, if he tried to challenge O'Connor as this sort of national leader, well, there was really only going to be one winner, and that was not going to be O'Brien. He didn't have that same charisma, that same control over a newspaper as well. He didn't have that same organizational ability probably either. And so if he was going to be one of the main leaders of Chartism, he was going to have to accept O'Connor's overall leadership and the fact that their personal relationship was starting to falter anyway because of the period in prison and the various accusations that arose out of that. And O'Connor really couldn't allow somebody to make accusations against him because of his own status as leader and his wish to sustain that. He couldn't allow others to... And O'Brien wasn't the only one by any means that fell foul of O'Connor's anger and sort of counter charges against. And there was a very sort of unsavory exchange of you know, different charges and claims and counterclaims and so on that went on, which probably damaged the movement as well. But after prison, when O'Brien got out in September of 1841, after prison, it's going to be very difficult for him, and that proved to be the case.
And yet, while the last two decades of his life really represent a diminishment of his fortunes compared to the 1830s, you describe in your book that he still has this very large standing among radicals throughout England, and how these people had this great devotion to him as a writer and activist.
Yeah, he does retain a following, and eventually there will be a very important organization, the National Reform League, at the end of the 1840s that he sets up, and it's linked in with some of his newspaper ventures as well. And there are branches of the National Reform League around the country, but the biggest one is in London. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of we're talking about, you know, a fairly small number, hundreds, really. But they're very committed, and in their own communities, they're influential as well. And because he's still got this very ambitious program, because he's combined the 6 points of the Charter with this social and economic program to do with things like the poor law and the land and adjusting the currency and taxation and debts. I mean, he was really the foremost champion of nationalization of the land, to make sure that it would be a resource for the whole people, and changing the system of currency. These are very bold ideas, and ideas about public marts as well, where you could exchange goods and products and services and so on, and making credit available for people so that they could get some land, or they could invest in some sort of industrial enterprise or on a small scale, whatever it might be. So he has this very far-reaching vision of, this is how you can get social equality. This is how you can get economic justice. And I think a lot of people bought into that and were interested in it. And some of them, of course, even tried to live it out, as I mentioned, for example, in small model communities where they tried to live out these ideas. So he's also somebody who's drawing together intellectual forces, in a way that maybe other radical leaders were not. I mean, it's not just his own experiences and his own preferences that are affecting his political program. He's drawing on a radical heritage, as I mentioned before Chartism, actually. You know, he's drawing on a lot of those things that go back, the sort of established radical culture, going back to people like Thomas Paine and William Cobbett. I mean, Cobbett had a lot of followers too still in the 1830s and 1840s. And so there's the link with some of Cobbett's ideas helps O'Brien too. Also, you know, industrialization, urbanization, new ideas about class, ideas of the rights of labor and what that should mean, you know, capitalism as an exploitative system. Again, you know, some of that stuff is part of O'Brien's thinking too. So anyone who's affected by those things would have found in O'Brien things that they could relate to, things that they could, again, read about, think about. And other aspects of history, like the French Revolution. I mean, the fact that O'Brien popularizes a very positive view of the early French Revolution. Robespierre, you know, to O'Brien is a democratic champion. You know, Robespierre is almost like a model Chartist, you know, who has a lot to teach British radicals. And he writes a book about Robespierre. He gives lectures on Robespierre. You know, so in all these ways, he's combining lots of different trends that would have appealed to quite a number of people. They would have at least given him a hearing. They would have at least read some of his things, even if they didn't agree with all of it. They would have, you know, there would have been an opportunity there for O'Brien to sustain this following that he had. So he is a very important figure, and it goes on. I mean, some of his followers after his death, they continue to be active. They get involved in other movements. Some of them associate with people like Karl Marx, you know, when Marx is in London. So there are lots of these different avenues for influence that still exist, even though O'Brien personally is suffering poverty, is suffering bouts of ill health, and he's probably a bit depressed at times as well. There's a certain melancholy that comes through in some of his writing. His letters, some of his letters are very depressing in their and depressed in their tone. So there's despite the hardship, there are ways that he still has a certain appeal and an ability to carry on his influence.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
At the moment, I'm doing a book about. It's really a continuation of some of the things that I've been talking about. I'm very interested in British attitudes towards America in the 19th century and how that changed. I did a book a few years ago about British radicals and their changing views of America in the 19th century, and I'm interested in taking that a little bit further, maybe with a specific focus on the American Civil War and Reconstruction period and what that really meant to people in Britain, and especially why they thought that was an important war for them. You know, why the outcome of the American Civil War and Reconstruction would have had an impact on them and on their lives. And so I'm interested in maybe pushing that a little bit further and seeing some of the linkages, the continuities in some of that period, but particularly 1860s, 1870s, that kind of period.
Hmm. Sounds like fascinating work there.
Well, I hope so. Still early. It's still early stages, but I'm hoping that I just did an article about maybe some of the religious reasons why there was such interest in the American crisis of the secession and Civil War and Reconstruction, and what it was that maybe you know, if there were any religious motivations for getting interest. I found some very interesting material about the Episcopal Church in America and how it split and how it came together again. And obviously with Britain still having a state church, the Anglican Church, and regarding the Episcopal Church as a kind of, you know, as a sort of outgrowth of the established church in the Church of England, I got very interested in the way that might have shaped a perspective about America and the crisis that America was going through. So I just recently wrote a thing about that, which hopefully will be published later this year.
How interesting. Professor Turner, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.